This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Today, it's the local news roundup. And at last, we have a winner. On Tuesday in Atlanta, NFL owners brought an end to the Jerry Richardson era when they approved the sale of the Carolina Panthers. Richardson started the expansion team in 1993 and 25 years later turned a $200 million investment into a $2.2 billion sale. The buyer is David Tepper, and he won't have any trouble footing the bill. He's worth $11 billion. The Panthers' sale price is larger than the entire Mecklenburg County budget, which was also introduced this week. It includes a proposed tax hike, which would be the first in 5 years. And the Great Charlotte Scooter Debate turned the corner in recent days. We'll have an update on that. Joining me today on our panel is Kirsten Garris with Spectrum News Charlotte.
Good morning.
Welcome. Glenn Birkins from Q City Metro. Good morning.
Good morning.
Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Observer.
Good morning.
And David Borax from WFAE.
Hey, Eric.
So, David Tepper, we haven't said that name enough this week. Let's start with what he said during his first press conference in terms of the long-range future of the team.
What's the name of the team? Carolina Panthers. It's going to be the Carolina Panthers. And listen, there is a logical place for this team, and it's Charlotte. And it is the Carolina Panthers.
So, Katie Peralta, you were in Atlanta. Did you notice how he went a little Southern with that pronunciation there? It's a Pittsburgh guy doing a Southern accent, right?
He's trying.
So, what did you make of David Tepper's debut as the new owner of the Panthers?
You know, he didn't give a lot of specifics about what he will do when he comes to Charlotte officially as owner, and I guess the deal closes in July. But he did say a lot of the right things that people wanted to hear, specifically that the stadium is, or Charlotte is a logical place for the stadium. He emphasized that they are the Carolina Panthers, and they will remain that way. However, you know, he did say the thing about the two states or whatever it was, two Carolinas. So to us, it kind of left the door open a little bit. You know, what does that mean? He said the stadium, Charlotte's logical place for the stadium. Now, we had learned that they might be considering down the line some sort of other facility in South Carolina eventually. Now, these are totally preliminary talks. They could, you know, it's just an idea. But it kind of would make sense if you think about it. You know, they do training camp at Wofford, maybe move it to someplace a little bit more accessible to the fans in Charlotte. You know, there are ways to capitalize on a facility like that with sponsorships and things like that. So, you know, it certainly sounds like the Panthers are here to stay in Charlotte, but it might be kind of, you know, more of a regional attempt to make the team more accessible to the South Carolina fans too. But again, all preliminary, no need to freak out about the team moving, as we've been saying for the past 5 months.
I think he said all the things that he had to say as the new owner. He obviously could not come in here and leave open the door that he might move the team to South Carolina or Los Angeles or wherever. However, you know, personally, I'm not holding him to anything he says at this point. He said himself that he's just coming in. He doesn't really know what's what. And I don't think he knows what he's going to encounter down the road. And I don't mean tomorrow or even next season, but circumstances change. And teams, we've seen it in the NFL countless times, they move around. And so I don't think the Carolina Panthers are inherently immune to that going down the road. Do I think he has some plan to move the team down to Fort Mill or wherever? Probably not, but things might look a lot different in 5 years or whatever. So I think as a city, we have to take what he said in his initial comments with a grain of salt. And I think we have to be diligent about keeping the team if that's what we want to do.
Now, the one thing he did make clear in terms of what he knows is what fans want.
The first thing I care about is winning. The second thing I care about is winning. And the third thing I care about is you guys are smart. So that's on and off the field. That includes the charity aspect, community aspect, and how you make a community better. So you win a lot of ways, and I don't like to lose it anyway.
So, yeah, of course the fans want to win, but Glenn, what you're saying is, and what he said is, there's winning off the field as well. So how might that be defined, particularly when we get into negotiations?
I actually think winning is the best thing to keep the team here or any team anywhere. Typically, teams that move are not doing well, and they're not doing well because they're not winning. And when you win, you put people in the stands. When you win, it's easier to find sponsors. That's just the formula for economic success in sports. It's winning. If the team can stay competitive, Charlotte has an excellent chance of keeping this team for a long, long time.
It's also noteworthy that Tepper is seen among other owners as a deal maker, and he's known on Wall Street as, you know, one of the smartest hedge fund managers in the world, actually. So he's very well respected, and he's known to be pretty savvy. And I think that that's something that owners are looking forward to, you know, when it comes to, like, you know, sponsorship negotiations, like, you know, TV negotiations down the line. That's something that maybe they can leverage him with. And so that's a win for the entire league. Jerry Jones was talking to us, I guess, on like Tuesday night or whatever, and he was saying how it's a big compliment to have a guy like David Tepper come into the league. So that's kind of an off the field type of winning. Of course, he's also talking about the charity aspect of what he does. And he seems to donate a lot of money to different causes, you know, very involved in different causes like the Hurricanes in Miami and Puerto Rico. I also think this was in my personal takeaway. You know, we've been talking a lot about the Jerry Richardson investigation, and that's something that was like completely not discussed at the owners' meetings, and it was the, you know, elephant in the room. And I don't know how much he could have said about it, to be honest. But what he said kind of indicated to me that you know, as we kind of close the door on a legacy that's kind of tainted, you know, Jerry Richardson's, that maybe, hopefully, we can look forward to something that's different and maybe the anti-Jerry Richardson. You know, he said several times in the past week, I'm a person who values equality. You know, we treat men and women the same way. And, you know, I don't want to say that we need to read too far into that, because Glenn, you're right, we need to take what he says with a grain of salt. But at the same time, if you kind of present yourself as the anti-Richardson, then that might be, you know, a start.
So here's a chance for a new owner to come in, and they've got a challenge to rebuild the team in so many ways. I mean, certainly there's the reputation issues that came with Jerry Richardson's troubles here. There's the issue of maximizing the value of the team, and this guy's a businessman, and he's been pretty good at it. There are things that the Panthers don't have that other teams have. I mean, we always talk about things like parking and that sort of thing. This possibility of a training facility that could be a revenue generator in the future with sponsorships and that sort of thing. He's got a lot to do to turn this team around. And then there's the on-the-field piece, which is how is he going to invest in the team as far as personnel goes.
Well, and Katie, I wanted to ask you, because you were there and you saw the public relations gymnastics that were going on those 2 days. First of all, they sneaked Jerry Richardson into the owner's meeting so he can bid his farewell. But reporters and photographers, we didn't get any glimpse of him. So I wanted you to address that piece, but also the demeanor of David Tepper. You know, he's got a kind of puckish sense of humor. He likes to have a little back and forth with reporters, and I think it's safe to say that's very different than the current regime. So what did you make of both of those things going on at once?
It's really interesting that you paired those two next to each other, because I think you were there when we were like standing outside waiting for Richardson. We saw the Panthers PR people, you know, like waiting outside of the Whitley. And so we were like, oh, he must be coming. And then we heard another person say, oh, no, he's already here. Like, he's upstairs. So he'd clearly been, you know, sneaked in the back door. But Tepper, I mean, he arrives on Monday night. Everybody's waiting for him or other owners, you know, kind of trying to talk to whoever they can. And he's totally not used to the media swarm. I mean, people on Wall Street are like, cool, it's David Tepper. He's like a famous rich person. But here it was like, oh my God, a celebrity sighting. And he was like, oh my God, all the cameras. So he seemed a little bit uncomfortable at first. And then he kind of started to loosen up a little bit. He would, you know, throw jokes around. He joked with Joe Person and Ian Rappaport about their hair, because Tepper's bald and he likes to point that fact out a lot. he also kind of like was very like casual with the rest of us. You know, he would say, "Oh, it's the Charlotte Observer. Nice to finally put a name to the or put a face to the name." So I kind of thought that the self-deprecating kind of get to know you attitude was just something that was really shocking.
Change, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, we told his people that even if you do a press conference once every 5 years, it would be a step up from what we've seen. Jerry Richardson's last press conference was in 2011. So, you know, the bar is pretty low and they know that. So I think that, you know, they are eager to make themselves known here. And I think that we'll be seeing a lot more of that in the community come July when the deal closes.
Now, I think it's interesting also, and there's been a lot of reporting about this, how David Tepper feels about the president. Jerry Richardson has not been a person who's made political statements. He hasn't made many statements at all as the owner. But so we have the Panthers sale on Tuesday. The next day, the NFL owners come out with this new policy on the national anthem. And everyone in this room remembers that while the NFL had all these protests going on in Charlotte, it was basically crickets. And several of the players came out and said they were fearful of repercussions from Jerry Richardson. So, Glenn, I want to ask you about this. But before I ask you about this, I want to mention that Torrey Smith, who is a wide receiver acquired by the Panthers this offseason, posted this on Twitter. He said, "Appropriate respect for flag and anthem implies that guys were being disrespectful towards it, which is an opinion. Most people who believe that ignore the responses from the players and, more importantly, why men chose to protest." Glenn, it seems to me that this is going to be perhaps a very different Panthers approach toward protests if they continue this year. What do you think?
Well, I think, I think this was probably the best compromise that the league could expect. And frankly, it was probably the best compromise that we could expect as a nation. The problem with the old policy is that the players were required to be on the field during the anthem. And that change took effect several years ago. I don't remember when. So by allowing them to remain in the locker room, not requiring them to come out, if you don't want to stand, if you want to make a statement, I think it still gives them an opportunity to do that. But it also frees up the owners and the teams from having this albatross around their necks. And I think that's what's been lost in this conversation. These are businesses, and businesses do not like to get caught up in controversy. And while I part company with a lot of my friends on this topic, most of us, whether you work at Bank of America or some other big company in Charlotte, we could not go into those buildings, into those offices, and hang controversial banners, a Black Lives Matter banner or whatever in our cubicle. We would be told to take it down in short order. Well, these are businesses, too, and they don't like to get caught up in controversy. So I think this was a reasonable compromise. I hope that it opens the door to bring Colin Kaepernick back.
Kirsten, I want to go to you, but I also want to mention that as Commissioner Goodell and these owners were talking about how they were united, the NFL Players Association was coming out opposing this. So what do you make of the new anthem policy?
Well, I think it's also worth noting that it's kind of vague. So, you know, if a player does go out on the field and decides to kneel or do something else besides standing, the organization will be fine, but it doesn't say how much the fine would be, who would have to play it, is it the owner, is it the player itself, him or herself. So I think it's one of those things. You know, I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And if some owners say, hey, my team can do what they want to do, I will take the fine if they decide to kneel. And also, where does that money go? At least I don't know where that has been established. You know, it's one thing if that money goes towards a charity or something, because then you're furthering the discussion.
Got it. That's Kirsten Garris. We have to take a break. When we come back, it's time to talk taxes and, yes, scooters. This is Charlotte Talks.
This week on the FAQ City Podcast, WFAE listener Mark Doherty wants to know, where can you find Charlotte's ties to the American Revolution? We travel through time and the Queen City on this week's FAQ City. Download the podcast and contribute your own question on WFAE.org/FAQ City.
Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg. I'm in for Mike Collins, and it's the local news roundup. Our panel today is Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, David Borax from WFAE, Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Observer, and Glenn Birkins from Q City Metro. So let's move on to the Mecklenburg County budget. This week, Dina DiOrio presented her 2019 budget, and she's looking for a tax hike.
If the 1 cent tax increase proposed by the city manager is ultimately approved by the city council, the combined increase on a single-family home valued at $250,000 in the city of Charlotte amounts to less than $4 per month.
So, Kirsten Garris, I believe you were there. What was the reaction? What's been the reaction to that?
Well, Republicans aren't too happy about this tax hike because it is the first one proposed in 5 years, and it would be a 0.75 cent tax hike. So for those of us who aren't good at math, that is about $19 more a year for a home valued at $250,000. So in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't sound like a lot, but when you factor in the city's asking for a tax hike and their service fees that are going up, it starts to get a little pricey when you look at all those numbers combined. But Republicans have issues with it because they want to find a way to make this budget work without the tax hike, which is traditional. Most conservatives feel that way. But the reason why DiOrio is pushing for this, she wants to start this universal pre-K program. So she's looking for an extra $9 million to basically fund 33 new classrooms for pre-K, and that would help 600 children. And this is something county commissioners have talked about before. You know, they said, hey, we want to find a way to help our youngest children. It goes back to the Opportunity Task Force report. Yep, that kind of says, you know, we need to help those who are at the very youngest get ahead before they get behind. So that's kind of the whole point about this, but it's interesting to hear the reaction. People want to find a way to help preschoolers, but how do you pay for it and who pays for it is the question. And right now, taxpayers would be paying for it.
So when we talk about the county commission, it's a 6-3 majority for Democrats. What's your sense of how unified the Democrats are on this budget?
We'll see. Even Trevor Fuller, who pushed for this when he was chairman a couple of years ago, was kind of like, we need to see how the numbers shape out. He says, if we do a tax increase, let's make the most of this said tax increase. And that's how a lot of Democrats are feeling, is if we have to tax folks, let's make sure we get every dollar out of it to make sure it's used in the best way. And Dina DiOrio has also been kind of preparing for this. A couple of months ago, they did a survey kind of asking folks how much would you be willing to pay. And some folks says as many as $10 to $20 extra in taxes to fund universal pre-K. So this is something the community might be up for. It's just whether lawmakers pass it.
You know, and this is also, Eric, this is also money that will help for things that are being asked for right now, like school security improvements, more school nurses and that sort of things. And that's in the news right now, and I think she is betting that there is a groundswell of support for that. The two of the Republicans, Bill James and Jim Puckett, have come out and said that we'd like to find a way to go back and maybe squeeze some money out of the county departments to pay for this and get rid of that extra money that's needed. And, you know, I'm not sure how far they will go to do that. There may be some effort to do that, but we'll see what happens.
Exactly. Yeah. It's yet to find, in the grand scheme of things, $9 million is not that much in a budget of, you know,
1.7.
But then again, someone bought the Panthers for more, but I digress. but it's one of those things. They'll have to see where they could, you know, fudge the numbers here or there. I know Puckett said if it's for, he wants to know how many four-year-olds would need it. You know, some families may not need pre-K that's paid for. So I think that's the discussion, is how many children do you need the help? How many maybe don't need the help? And that's where they could look at the numbers and maybe trim down the cost.
I should mention that Dina DiOrio will be on this program Tuesday talking about that budget in depth. David mentioned education. So one of the pieces of this budget that's interesting is that it does not include the school system's request for a 7% teacher pay supplement from the county.
The county manager had to pick those things that she thought were the biggest investments that they could make. So we'll take that, we'll move forward together, and then we'll begin to look at our own budgets and see if there's not some way that we can better support our teachers.
Bad host. That is school superintendent Clayton Wilcox, which I should have told you at the beginning, but those were his comments in terms of the pay hike. I'm wondering, any surprise there that the teacher pay raise was not part of this county budget?
Not necessarily. I know DiOrio mentioned that that's something the state should handle. She says she respects that teachers marched on Raleigh. She says that's where those decisions are made and that's where the money should come from. She said they fully funded things like the support staff. It's not just counselors, it's psychologists. They also funded about $4.6 million for actual security enhancements, so hardening doors, bulletproof windows. So DiOrio's thinking is that's the state's job. You know, the state has promised a raise. They're the ones who should handle that.
So, Glenn, I can't remember, even though I should, the last time we've had both city and county tax hikes in the same year.
You're testing my failure.
No, I wasn't expecting. I mean, if you come up with a number, that's great. You know, Rain Man, Kmart, the whole thing. But it hasn't happened much, I think it's safe to say. And particularly when we're talking about an election year for the county, what impact, if any, do you see come the fall?
I don't know if this will have any impact at election time. As Kirsten pointed out, this isn't a huge number, and I don't want to downplay any tax increase. I was reading an article this week in the Charleston, South Carolina paper about the phenomenal growth that some of the larger cities in that state are seeing. It's the same here. Charlotte is just growing tremendously, and as it grows, its needs are growing, and somehow we have to figure out how we're going to pay for these needs. And I think most people kind of understand that and get it.
Do they get it, David?
I think people do get it. I think another factor this time around for both the city and the county is that there are some very clearly articulated needs that we have. Like in the city's case, they want to give raises to police officers. It's the school system on the county side. And I think the managers and some of the elected officials are thinking that if there was ever a time when people would be okay with a tax increase, this might be it. I did want to point out one other thing that's in the county budget, which is additional money this year to hire 11 more IT people to help prevent what happened last year with the cyber attack, where the county got hit with a ransomware attack that shut down a couple hundred systems for several weeks. And that's something that they have to do. The county manager has talked about how she wants to speed up the improvements that they're making and harden those systems so that we don't have this happen again.
I mean, I would guess on the ransomware piece, I can't imagine opposition to that by anyone who works in the county or on the board. But did we hear any?
I asked Jim Puckett actually about that because I was like, hey, do you think this is enough? And he said, you know what, I can't gauge if this is enough or not because he'll leave it up to the experts. But he was happy to see it in there because I think everyone agrees you don't want to get hacked. But if you do, you do have to find a way to prevent that from happening because that crippled the county for several weeks. And it isn't just the county office. You forget how much the county does until something breaks. And that's what we saw last year, is that the county is well connected with so many different things you need for everyday life. So I think they're trying to find a way to prevent that from happening again.
And so both those budgets and the proposed tax increases will be voted on in June.
Correct, because the budget has to be ready by July 1st.
Okay, so speaking of budgets, Democrats in the state legislature are unhappy this week about how the Republican majority is deciding the $23 billion budget for the new year. David, you reported on this a little bit. How is this different from what's been done in previous years?
Well, this year the Republicans, let's talk about what this is. This is a budget that was approved last year by the legislature. This is the short session. They come back this year, and they basically make tweaks to the budget to account for things that they couldn't see a year ago. And so usually in this process, it comes to the legislature, and there's an opportunity for amendments on this bill. The Republicans this time have done most of the work behind closed doors, and they have not allowed the Democrats to have a shot at doing anything. The governor is out there talking about wanting more money for education. He was in Huntersville yesterday talking about this. It's probably not going to be heard very well in the legislature where these things are being done this way. Democrats are crying foul on this. The Republicans are saying, well, we can do this.
Yeah, and the odds that the Republican majority is going to listen to the Democratic minority would be? Yeah.
The odds, zero.
Okay. I'm just making sure that I'm following along here. Another story you were following in terms of what's going on in Raleigh, the Reverend William Barber, who once led the state NAACP, was back in Raleigh on Monday, and he brought demonstrators with him. What are they asking for, and how did that turn out?
Well, this week, I think the topics they were looking at was immigration issues and the broad issue of racism. They were back at the state legislature protesting, and 13 people were arrested this time. Remember, a week ago, 50 people were arrested on the week that the legislature opened. This is part of the National People's Campaign, which Barber is leading, and it's 30 cities across the country, state capitals, and they're going to be doing this for 6 weeks. So we have four more weeks of this. It's just an effort, as happened here with the Moral Mondays, to raise the profile of some of these issues and make sure that it's in the public debate as legislators are doing things like the budget.
And Reverend Barber always stresses that he is his group is nonpartisan, but these are primarily Democratic issues that we're talking about, correct?
They are, and you know, the Republicans have used that and said this is an attack by Democrats on them, and you know, the folks from the People's Campaign have shot back that we haven't said anything about political parties here, but it is sort of a one side against the other on this.
So, Democrats and Republicans, let's talk about that from a city council perspective. On this program and on Spectrum News, LaWanna Mayfield, a Democratic council person who has been in the news a lot lately, I think it's safe to say, was discussing some of her comments which have stirred controversy. And at the same time, her Republican colleague, Tark Bakari, went on a police ride and very publicly gave his thoughts on what serving as a policeman is like. So I'm going to start with you, Kirsten. What do you make of both of these council members and kind of their public profile right now?
Yeah, well, these comments kind of came, if you haven't seen the news, I know LaWanna Mayfield posted a tweet back in March that basically likened police officers to terrorists. And she accompanied that tweet with a video from Stephon Clark's mother, who is, Stephon Clark was an African-American man unarmed and shot and killed by police in Sacramento. When she came on Spectrum News, she talked one-on-one with one of our anchors, and she said she wanted to, she says her posts aren't always Charlotte-focused because she wants to show that different injustices are happening across the country, not just here in Charlotte. And her point was she is not just a council person, but a community advocate, a community activist, and she wants to make sure she is vocalizing these issues because if any change happens, it's policy change, and she's in a place to make that change. So she's definitely standing by her guns on these comments, and I know we asked her, will you talk to the Fraternal Order of Police? Because they reached out to her after seeing those comments and said, hey, we don't understand. Help us understand the intent of these issues, and we want to try and work it out and understand it better. She says they have not reached, FOP had not reached out to her whole 7 years on council. She says until they, quote unquote, her words are, until they start telling the truth about police brutality, she isn't ready to talk with them. So that's one side of the issue. In light of all these comments, Tark Bakari, who's a new Republican on council, he says, in light of Police Week, the budget season where we've seen police officers come in the hundreds asking for a pay raise, he wanted to go on a ride-along and see, well, what is it like? So he actually did third shift, so that's the overnight shift where who knows what's going to happen, can happen. And he was there with officers from domestic violence calls to shots fired, and he recorded all this because he wants to make some kind of documentary to show the behind-the-scenes look of what it's like to be an officer. And then he penned this really long letter to CMPD officers saying, hey, I saw some of the worst of our city that night, but then I saw the best in our department. So he really valued them. And he's been pushing for what he calls an extraordinary raise for police officers. We don't know what that will be. The budget says a 6.5% raise, but Tariq Bakari all season has said he wants an extraordinary raise for these public servants.
Well,
and the
right.
Police themselves were asking for 15%. So
yep.
The budget does not meet that. I think the question between now and the time they approve it is can they come up with some more money to goose that number a little bit?
Yeah, that's why I was going to mention the 15%, because they're not happy with the city manager's proposal. Glenn, before the show, we were talking a little bit about ride-alongs and just the whole process. What did you make of Tark Bakari's sort of letter to the police and the community after his experience this week?
I think ride-alongs are extremely informative, educational. I think everyone, if we could, should do a ride-along to actually see what police officers are facing. Excuse me. But I would also point out that ride-alongs, at their best, are, you know, public relations gimmicks to some degree. You are not going to go with an, you know, officers are naturally going to be on their best behavior.
And Glenn is going to grab a sip of water. But Kirsten, when Tark Bakari is talking about an extraordinary raise, how much are we hearing from other members of the council, you know, that they want more than the 6.5%?
I think it's clear city council members want to support police in some way, because this is not the first time they've asked for a raise. They came last year asking for a similar amount. But it's how do you make that raise? And I think it's the big question is, how do you fix the pay plan system? That's what came up this year, is that there is a lot of just misunderstanding about how this pay plan system works. How does it really benefit people? Because if you take away a step, rookies might be making more than someone who's been at the department for 10 years. So it's kind of like, how do you fix a system that is kind of convoluted, but you want to give people a raise but make sure everyone's getting some kind of raise? So that's kind of what they have to figure out.
Okay, Glenn, you're back.
Yeah, I think when you look at our problem, the police department's problem with hiring, clearly it's going to have to be addressed, and pay is going to have to be part of that. laws of supply and demand don't cease simply because it's the police department. So if we're going to recruit and retain good officers, we're going to have to pay for them. But I want to go back to Luana Mayfield and her comments, because I think if we look beyond the hyperbole, and sometimes I think it's unfortunate hyperbole, she's actually raising points that should be heard. This isn't a Charlotte problem. This isn't a North Carolina problem. There is a problem between the African American community and police departments across the country. There's been a loss of trust. She's not telling us anything we don't know. If you are paying any attention at all on social media or news for that matter, we know this. And I hope that this does not get lost behind what I think sometimes might be the unfortunate hyperbole behind her message. This is a problem that we need to confront, and it's something we need to address.
You know, it's the way she's saying it. It's the tone and the, you know, using language like police are terrorists and that sort of thing, which has kind of attracted the attention to her and her comments and brought it away from that larger issue that you're talking about, which I agree.
You know, given, I guess, how quickly, political skirmishes sort of turn into big political skirmishes, I'm wondering whether anybody is surprised that, particularly with the 9/11 tweet when she said, "I'm still waiting for someone to produce pieces of the alleged plane that opened the doors for U.S. citizens to lose all privacy rights." Anyone surprised that it was a rather muted response from her colleagues and from the mayor?
I don't think so. I think that they're trying to direct the conversation away from attacking her as a person and her use of social media and rather focus on the issues at hand. At least that was my takeaway. And I think that that's probably a supportive role to take. But like Glenn said, there are underlying issues that as a civic leader, you kind of have a duty to present those ideas in ways that won't divide people further. And unfortunately, I think that that's what they have done. So they're focusing more on the ideas that she's bringing forth, not exactly how she's doing them. And, you know, I think that the ways those two posts in particular, I think that those are good examples of ways that, points that need to be raised, but in effect, they might have divided people even more than she had realized, or maybe she would have ever intended to. There are ways to call out police brutality without calling police terrorists, and kind of isolating that faction and pitting police against, whatever. I don't know, without making them out to be the, bad guys.
And I would draw a huge line between her comments about 9/11 and her comments about the police department. There's not been a shred of evidence that 9/11 was anything but what we know it to be.
We'll be right back on Charlotte Talks. Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg. I'm in for Mike Collins, and we are continuing on the local news roundup. Our panel today is Kirsten Garris of Spectrum News, Katie Peralta of the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins from Q-City Metro, and David Borax from WFE. Now we come to the real news of the week, the scooter policy.
Scootergate.
Yes, dun, Scootergate. Dun, dun. Somebody's going to win a Nobel for solving the scooter dilemma. So three companies, Lime, Bird, and Spin, now have permits to put electrical rental scooters on Charlotte streets. That's after one of the companies, Lime, tried to introduce scooters earlier this month without a permit. The city put a stop to that, but Lime's regional manager, Sydney McLaurin, spoke to David Borax this week about what happened.
Conversations with the city and several business leaders in the city prior to launching scooters. And so when we originally launched them, we felt that we had the support to go ahead and launch them. After the launch, we had some other conversations with the city, and their request was that we give them some time to actually work on an official permit. From their perspective, that would be a sort of cleaner way to manage it. And so we agreed to a 10-day hold on services so they had time to do the permit process. And so that permit is now officially done, and we are back on the street.
And Larkin Eggleston, who is a Democratic councilman, says that all of this discussion is really all about choices.
Bike shares, certainly, but also the scooters to some extent for certain folks provide that last mile, first mile connectivity that might get someone from their house or their place of work to to a light rail station or to a bus stop.
So, David, this really all starts with you, because not only did you interview Sidney McLaurin, but you have lived the great scooter debate. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, as the environmental reporter at the paper, I thought I would check out this little piece of sustainability. So when I covered a meeting at the City Hall yesterday, I took the train down from University to 7th Street Station downtown, and then I hopped on a scooter and took it over to City Hall. And it worked great. I think it cost me 75 cents with the discount as a new user.
You didn't hit anybody or anything?
Didn't hit anybody. I didn't see anybody while I was out there. I rode on sidewalks where I did see one other guy on a scooter. But the point that Larkin Eggleston is making here is that this is a way to add to the transportation system that last mile. So I think it would have taken me maybe 15 minutes to walk down to the government center on the scooter. It was about 3 minutes, and it was actually kind of fun. But you know, what's going on here is that we have something that's completely new. It's disrupting the marketplace, as they say. And that is part of what happened when Lime came in here at the beginning of May and just put their scooters out on the streets. And, you know, it's one of those cases where let's just try this and we'll, you know, ask for forgiveness later. And this is not the only place they've done it. There's another case this month in Hawaii where they put them out on the streets of Hawaii, of Honolulu. The mayor there declared them illegal and ordered the police to remove them from the streets. And they're in a little bit of a battle there to try and get things opened up there. I think here in Charlotte, the way it worked out, I think we had a process previously to get the bicycles, the rental bicycles out on the streets, and the company already had a relationship with the city, as Sidney McLaurin mentioned there in that cut. And I think that they, you know, there was a desire to work it out. I mean, some of the younger members of the council are really excited about these different kinds of transportation options, and they'd like to see them happen. And maybe Charlotte's attitude is a little more of how do we make it happen as opposed to this is illegal.
I think what we're all waiting to see is whether this is truly the beginning of a shift in how we get around within the city, or if this is kind of a fad. I know that it's happening not just here in Charlotte. It's happening in a lot of cities around the country. You know, that's what I want to know. And perhaps we'll only know in hindsight when we look back at this. But in 5 years, are we still going to see bike shares and scooters and or is this just a moment in time?
So you know, I feel compelled to ask our millennial panel members, Katie and Kirsten.
Those who can ride a scooter.
That's right. Why are we obsessed with bikes and scooters all of a sudden?
Well, first of all, you know, there's always been talk about, you know, making Charlotte a more walkable city. But I think, you know, going along with the walkability factor is the bikeability factor, you know, just driving fewer cars, period, you know, whether it's taking a light rail or hopping on a scooter or whatever. But I think it's also all about just, you know, like you said before, choices. And the dockless aspect of these makes it such that you can truly just drop them wherever you want, probably not in the middle of the street. I think that's not,
not
know, probably
not,
frowned
probably
upon.
Not this.
we do need some etiquette here.
Right.
Small etiquette. Just a little bit.
But then the scooters add yet another option for people. I mean, I think I tweeted right when they came out. I've never used one, but I was wearing a skirt one particular day, and I was like, oh, I actually couldn't ride a bike in a skirt. So a scooter, you could. I have like a calf injury right now, so that would help, you know, like if I had to go like 2 miles and it was a pain to you know, drive there and park. So I think that it feels cool to be, you know, a biking city, and it's good to have options. And that's, I don't think that's necessarily a young people thing. I think it's just a, you know, a good thing to have cheap options. And it's interesting that it comes at a time when the city is like expanding its own docked bike program. They're going to be adding docks all over the city, and even parts of like, you know, south of Uptown where you wouldn't typically see those. So there's a little bit of competition going on between the city's program and the dockless bikes. So, you know, when competition among companies happens, the people who benefit are typically, or they're supposed to be, the consumers. So that's good news.
And I think we're also a city of convenience. It's convenient to not have to own a bike or own a scooter, but you can just pick one up, like David said, get from the light rail to your destination in 2 minutes versus 15. And I think it's also just a changing mindset of who's coming to the city. 66 people a day, I think, is a new number, and a lot of them are millennials. And I've heard some people just anecdotally saying, well, I'm not bringing a car because I see Charlotte has light rail. I see Charlotte has bikes and whatnot. So I think we are trying to shift towards, well, who is coming? What do they want? And they want convenience for transportation.
I actually have two bicycles cluttering my garage, and I've thought about getting rid of them because I see dockless bikes outside of my house all the time. So why do I need those two bicycles taking up space in my garage? I think you raised a very good point there, Kirsten. With me, I want dedicated bike lanes. I want more dedicated bike lanes to feel safe. I'm still not really comfortable getting out there riding a bicycle in traffic because we have too many drivers who simply don't respect bike riders.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask next is, you know, assuming this becomes a thing and it seems to be coming, you know, it's gaining traction very rapidly, it seems like there are going to be some big local government implications here because I guess the poster child for this would be Portland. Well, they have a very dedicated, built-out system of bike lanes. And whether you're going to be Portland or not, to support this, you've got to have the infrastructure.
The more of these vehicles that we have on the roads, the more we have to solve that problem. I mean, everybody's going to be complaining about, oh, look at all these bikes. Oh, the scooters are in the way. You know, we're going to have to deal with that. I want to answer.
It's interesting that people do that. They don't complain about surface parking lots, for example.
I want to answer one of your questions, Glenn, which is that at least at this point, the problem with the shared vehicles is that when I came out of the government center yesterday, my scooter was gone.
Oh, and it's worth noting, the city manager wants to fully fund the Charlotte Bikes program, $4 million, which would include trying to make sure Charlotte becomes a more bikeable city. Now, whether that gets it approved or not, we'll find out in June, but it is in the budget for now.
And one reminder here, this is all just in a trial period. Both the bike share and the scooter share programs, the city will reevaluate that in the fall and make a decision in October whether to change the programs, end them, try and do more with them. We'll see what happens.
So Scootergate lives a little bit longer.
All right. So a slightly less environmentally friendly mode of transportation, that would be NASCAR racing. This is Memorial Day weekend, and part of Memorial Day weekend in this part of the country has been the Coca-Cola 600 for 50 years or more. Katie, you cover sports business. Just what's the state of NASCAR as they come to their big moment in Charlotte this weekend?
It's been a lot of chatter recently about the state of NASCAR because there have been reports that the France family is considering selling their majority stake in the business. And it's interesting that we call it a business. You know, it's an organization. It's a governing body. It's a sport. It's unlike the NFL. Like, the NFL is not going up for sale. The MLS isn't going up for sale. But because the France has owned so much of it from day one, it comes at a critical moment for the sport because, you know, like other sports, NASCAR has been dealing with declining ratings. They've had sponsorship issues. They've lost target lows. They'll lose Monster, I guess, after next year.
Yeah.
So it comes at a time when there might be a need for some fresh leadership. Now, I feel like I've, you know, gotten some heat for writing quote-unquote doom and gloom stories about NASCAR, but a fresh pair of eyes, you know, a fresh leadership at NASCAR might not necessarily be a bad thing. You know, they're trying to attract more young fans, a more diverse fan base, and a more diverse, driver base as well. So it might not necessarily be the worst news ever that, you know, NASCAR might be headed in a fresh direction. And I think that, it comes at a time, of course, 600 is one of the biggest races of the year. So there's obviously a lot of attention on Charlotte right now. By the way, look out for traffic and, well, I guess it was last night. Never mind. Right. Wasn't Speed Street last night?
Oh, no, it's through Saturday.
Okay. Saturday. Yes. Yep.
Road closures until Sunday morning.
It's there. Right.
She almost lost her Uptown card for that.
Going out of town for the weekend.
Just one other point to piggyback on what you're saying, Katie. This isn't just NASCAR's issue. It's an issue in racing in general. NASCAR itself recently acquired or is in the process of acquiring the ARCA circuit, which is another American racing circuit with similar kinds of cars. In fact, there was an ARCA race last night in Charlotte for the first time in like 15 years or something. But the Formula One circuit was sold last year to a media company. And so there's a lot of shifting. I think there's There's some sponsorship money out there that's waiting to be gotten, and these companies are trying to figure out how to position themselves best to do it. And as you pointed out, the Frances are – it's basically a family business, and I think it may be time for NASCAR to become something more than a family business.
Yeah, and part of the problem is, for example, this week the new Hall of Fame class was announced. Jeff Gordon, 96% of the vote. Not too shabby. No one's gotten 100% yet, but you know, part of the problem is that the guy who's going into the Hall of Fame is one of the guys that the fans would really like to see back on the track.
Yeah, they've definitely been losing a lot of their quote-unquote stars. You know, Dale Earnhardt was voted, like, you know, most popular in the sport for like 14 years or something like that. He obviously had the family name recognition going for him. So they, you know, the NASCAR itself is doing a huge, like, they're making a huge effort to groom young drivers from the start. You know, they have programs to help, you know, raise their profile and get them out in the community. That said, there's still not a ton of diversity. They might have like fun, flashy personalities. You know, Austin Dillon, we had a story about him, I guess this morning or yesterday, but there are some standouts. Danica, you know, obviously is out. Bubba Wallace is a huge name to follow right now. I believe he's the only African-American driver in the sport right now. But you know, they definitely need to keep doing that work to bring drivers up. And it's not the easiest sport to get into, by the way. I mean, you have to have a lot of money to start being a NASCAR driver. So,
yeah, as a lot of people have always told me, you don't go outside and play NASCAR in the backyard. So
right.
It makes it difficult. by the way, Katie just mentioned a few minutes ago that Lowe's is one of the sponsors who has left NASCAR. By the way, someone else has left the building when it comes to Lowe's. Glenn, you wrote about that a little bit this week.
Lowe's has a new president and CEO. His name is Marvin Ellison, and he's a retail veteran, having worked for Home Depot, where I believe he was over store operations or something pretty much nationwide. And most recently, he was in charge of the turnaround effort at JCPenney.
And that made me wonder, how are things going at JCPenney? So is that a good pick?
Well, so when people heard JCPenney, they're like, oh, God, you know, it's not exactly like Sears. He'd only been at JCPenney since, I believe, 2015. And he has done a pretty significant job, you know, stabilizing the revenue. He's cleaned up their balance sheet quite substantially, you know, not to be too wonky, but it is worth noting, and a lot of people have noted, that their share price has gone down since being there. And he put out a video this week, basically pretty heartfelt and like very honest. He said to shareholders, you know, I'm really proud of the work that I did here, but I didn't do enough in raising the share price, and it's time for a fresh set of eyes, or you know, fresh leadership at JCPenney. You know, I would think that a fresh, you know, something fresh in retail is always good. At this particular juncture, it's a really tough time for department stores. For Lowe's has had a lot of change come in recently. They have a new activist investor, in fact. So I think, you know, he's had a lot of retail experience already. People point to his time at Home Depot. Home Depot has traditionally been a lot stronger than Lowe's. So this might be, you know, bringing in someone with a little bit of inside knowledge about Home Depot might be a
good
thing.
Can't do any better than bringing in a guy that once helped run your top competitor, right?
Exactly.
And he is an African American,
yes.
And this is a company that has had some scrutiny over diversity in the executive ranks in past years, right?
Yes, I've spoken with former employees who see it kind of as a bit of a old boys club, old white guys club specifically. Niblock had been CEO for about 13 years. I think it was early last year, Lowe's was facing a racial discrimination lawsuit from a former executive who said he was wrongfully terminated because he was black. Now, Lowe's has said that these accusations are, you know, misplaced and there was, you know, some sort of miscommunication or something. But this guy said basically, like, he was pitted against Niblock and there was already a succession plan in place for him to become CEO. You know, this comes at a time also when the C-suite is very white already. Wall Street Journal put out a story, I think on Tuesday, the day before the Ellison promotion or I think that's when it was. Anyway, it was near the same time. So the number of black CEOs remains flat. You know, he went from JCPenney to Lowe's, and they're calling out this fact at a time when Lowe's is struggling with this problem already, so...
So Katie Peralta gets the last word, but we have to salute Kirsten Garris, who has been named one of Charlotte's 30 Under 30 this week. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
I want to thank Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, David Borax from WFAE, Glenn Birkins from Q City Metro, and Katie Peralta of the Charlotte Observer for joining me. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and you've been listening to Charlotte Talks. Have a happy Memorial Day weekend.
WFAE is proud to launch a new investigative podcast called She Says, which looks at one sexual assault survivor's efforts to bring her assailant to justice. Find out more at WFAE.org/She Says.